Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Scientists across America say they are thrilled with the new White House, a president pledging to restore science to its rightful place, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist setting energy policy, others of their ilk in major advisory roles. It's a big shift from the Bush years, but new polls put the environment low on the priority list for the American people. And there are bumps in the road ahead with big expectations for stem cell research and climate change. This hour on Point, President Obama's science agenda. You can join our conversation. Does science need to be restored to its rightful place in policymaking? Is the president right to put the environment front and center? Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Francesca Griffo, senior scientist and director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Francesca, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you. And with us from New York City is John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. John, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Francesca, let me start with you. When President Obama says he's pledging to restore science to its rightful place, where has science been, to your mind, to this point?
Well, I think we've seen a profound increase in the amount of abuses of science over the last administration. I mean, obviously this is not something that they invented, but it is certainly something that went to heights and, you know, a depth and breadth that we haven't seen. Falsification, fabrication, censorship, suppression. But the major idea is, you know, not using science as part of the policy process, but rather taking that science and, you know, tailoring it to fit a preconceived outcome.
Falsification, fabrication, John Rennie, those are strong words. Is the president just referring to the past 8 years, and do those words apply in your mind?
Well, unfortunately, it does seem like there's a very clear pattern of that does apply. There are a number of cases in which various scientists associated with different agencies from NASA and others that they had views that were at odds with the past administration's positions, and they were discouraged from speaking out, or their results were in some cases were discouraged from being released formally. So it's hard to disagree with the view of the scientists that they have definitely been shut out of Washington as informed consultants anyway.
Beyond being included now, I guess, is the message that I'm hearing from you in these circles again. Francesca, what do scientists think need to be changed? What needs to be done about the way government and science work together in terms of policy and attitudes?
Well, I think, you know, we have a five-pronged approach, because I think, you know, it's very hard to say, oh, how am I going to stop abuse of science in one, you know, with one act or one deed or one executive order? We've seen some very promising signs on transparency. Today, Congress will be voting on whether or not to add an amendment to the stimulus bill that would protect whistleblowers who would report waste, fraud, and abuse in that stimulus package or in the use of those funds. And there's a lot that's gone wrong with the regulatory process, and so we have to look at some reforms there. In addition, you know, we really have to look at scientific advice. We have to look at our new science advisor and the level that he'll be appointed at, and we have to take a really strong look, I think, at monitoring and enforcement of the scientific issues as well.
Here's a quote from Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the January 19th broadcast of the California Report. She's talking about the future of science in this new administration, making it clear that she intends for science to drive decision-making.
If you want to see what our agenda is, think of four words: science, 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 and science. Science for the best possible health care for our children, science for technology, engineering, mathematics, and all the rest for our recovery package, whether it's rebuilding our infrastructure or improving our health care system or investing in innovation.
John Rennie, science driving policy. In practical terms, what might that mean?
Well, that is, of course, music to the ear of ears of scientists. But a lot of people would worry, for example, that does that mean that what the scientists say should necessarily be taken as gospel, that the scientists will be dictating policy? And I don't think anybody believes that that's what the Obama administration intends to do. Rather, it's the case that the administration intends to actually listen to the scientific evidence and the best informed recommendations coming from the administration's science advisors, and then draw whatever sorts of good policies that hit the most appropriate balance between the scientific facts as they're determined and whatever the other kind of policy goals that need to be set are.
Who has the team that's been assembled, Francesca? Who are these people, and what does that say about his approach, President Obama, to science moving forward?
Well, I think he has some amazing team members. I think, you know, if we look at Dr. Chu at the head of the Energy Agency, Dr. Lubchenco at the head of NOAA, if we look at Dr. Holdren, who's going to be the science advisor and the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, Dr. Varmus, who's going to be part of PCAST, which is the President's Council on Scientific and Technical Advice. I mean, I think there is a long list of fabulous people that are there. So I think we have, you know, good people in good places, and they have quite an agenda ahead of them.
John Rennie, what has the president done just in the past week, to your mind, if anything, to signal change?
Well, I mean, I think everything connected to the stimulus budget and the development of that is sending very important signals that he recognizes that science and scientific programs can play a big part in trying to get the country back on the right course economically. That one of the other important things that happened just last weekend was the announcement that his instructions to the EPA that it should grant California and other states a waiver that would allow them to start to set their own car tailpipe emission standards. That's seen as a very important movement toward trying to push the United States as a whole toward better emission standards that are going to help improve the state of our climate change policy.
Let's listen to that. Here's President Obama signing that executive order on Monday, reversing the Bush administration policies on car emissions, on fuel efficiency standards. As John said, it signaled a sharp break from the environmental policies of the past 8 years.
Rigid ideology has overruled sound science. Special interests have overshadowed common sense. Rhetoric has not led to the hard work needed to achieve results. And our leaders raise their voices each time there's a spike in gas prices, only to grow quiet when the price falls at the pump. Now America has arrived at a crossroads. Embedded in American soil, in the wind, in the sun, we have the resources to change.
Francesca Griffo, we have the resources to change. America is at a crossroads, but new polls show that the environment is very low on the priority list for the American people right now, with so many other problems out there.
Well, I think that is going to be the work of, you know, the advocacy community and the, you know, scientific community over the next 4 years, is to really make sure that we don't forget these issues, because in fact there are many, many competing priorities. But I would say even more broadly than, you know, the excerpt that you just played was, you know, Lisa Jackson's memorandum that she sent out to all the folks at EPA talking about how she is going to, you know, really lead that agency with a lot of openness, and how she's going to rely on the hardworking and talented employees at EPA for doing that work. And I think, you know, we just have to work harder to make the connections so that regular folks really understand that it's not a dichotomy between economic success and a clean world, that these are, in fact, paths that are, you know, intricately connected and actually, you know, mutually reinforcing, and that really we have to move forward using both aspects of it.
John Rennie, speak to the feeling in the scientific community, generally speaking. I mean, to any of these points, has there been any sort of, backlash in the scientific community and the way they've been treated, and how they feel about, you know, how their voice should have been heard?
Well, I mean, in the past administrations, or in the case of how it's registering with Obama so far and the agenda that
so
he's setting?
So far now, the agenda he's setting.
Well, I think so far everybody within the scientific community still feels like they're in the slightly giddy honeymoon stage of things. Mm-hmm. Everybody's having a very good time. Everybody is extremely encouraged by the sorts of statements that the president and others have been making about how welcome science and scientific advice is going to be in setting an agenda for the administration. Needless to say, as time goes by and as actual policies start to drop into place, there's plenty of time for people to start to get a little more disillusioned. For example, in the development of the stimulus package, which is sort of the giant perfect nexus of trying to simultaneously try to fix what's wrong with the economy and also trying to advance some of the energy and climate change goals that are being pursued. There are already some members of the scientific community who are a little disappointed that there is not more stimulus that is being given there to mass transportation. There's a lot that's being given to repairs to the highway system, which is very important, but a lot they wish there was more encouragement toward trying to convince people to change their patterns of behavior and get them to be taking trains or subways or other kinds of mass transit more often.
Francesca, would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think, there is a lot of money currently going to the National Science Foundation. That's a grand thing. You know, there's the potential of being able to protect government scientists when they report this waste, fraud, and abuse by protecting them as whistleblowers. That's a grand thing. But obviously, you know, every piece of legislation represents many, many compromises and a lot of discussion. But I think, you know, really the point of it as it moves forward, I mean, I think most people are pretty pleased.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about science policy and the Obama administration. With us from Washington this hour is Francesca Griffo, director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And with us from New York City is John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American magazine. You brought up the stimulus package before the break, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, the funding that might go into some of these scientific projects. I've got some of the numbers in front of me. $825 billion stimulus package, President Obama's aims to, among other things, double the production of renewable energy in 3 years. He's allocated $13 billion for federal research and development, including $3 billion to the National Science Foundation, $3.5 billion to the National Institutes of Health, $500 million for construction of the NIH campus in Bethesda, and on it goes, $1.5 billion to build university research facilities. I'm curious, Francesca Griffo, how might, practically speaking, Americans see the benefits of all of these investments?
Well, I think, you know, the connection between, scientific information and a successful America is one that's, you know, certainly been something we've relied on for a very long time. I mean, I think, you know, Obama himself in many, many speeches during the campaign and afterwards has really talked about how, you know, funding for scientific research has yielded innovations that have, you know, vastly improved the landscape of American life. I mean, the internet, digital photography, barcodes, you know, anything you want to pull out of the air, I think, there are so many ways in which it will. But I think one of the things we're really struggling with right now are, you know, we're looking at climate, we're looking at health care, we're looking at, you know, so many issues like that that are really, the big deals right now, I think, for the public. And obviously, you know, in order to answer those questions, more information is going to be terribly important.
Right. If I could jump in on that.
Yes, John,
too,
go ahead.
I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting about why you're seeing this, you know, $13 billion worth of funding that's set aside for federal R&D in the stimulus package is that the administration is acknowledging that part of what may be very necessary in terms of actually turning the economy around in a long-term sustainable way is setting up a new kind of infrastructure, particularly with respect to our energy and how the energy policy will affect our climate policies down the line, and also with respect to health care, because obviously the state of health of people in this nation very concretely determines how well they're able to work and how well the economy is going to be able to do. So, in fact, a lot of the specific targeted programs that are within the stimulus package that's being defined definitely go toward, in a way, not just kind of repairing the infrastructure of roads and things that we know of now, but trying to create a brand new energy infrastructure that's going to be extremely important in making sure that the United States is both environmentally sustainable but also economically sustainable decades from now.
Talk more about that energy infrastructure, John. What might that entail?
Well, it can be a lot of things. And for example, this explains why it is that I think there are like $4.5 billion in the package are going toward developing a kind of smart power grid. Right now, the sort of electrical grid we have across the country, it distributes energy, but not as efficiently as it could, and it can't do a very good job of being able to reach out to the places where we could draw the most from solar power or from wind power. There's a lot of funding in there that would try to help to promote renewable energy technologies, and that's very important for us to be able to become less dependent on coal or other fossil fuels. There's a big allocation of, I think, $2.5 billion or so that would go toward trying to develop, they talk about carbon capture and sequestration technologies, which are things that people are looking at as a way of trying to make sure that if you are burning coal, that it's not pumping as much carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere and suffering bad and climate effects as a result of that. All of these are the kinds of things that are really likely to be, even beyond their just sort of environmental value, are very likely to be the foundations for what future major economic success is going to be. This is an argument that Tom Friedman was making in his recent book.
It's all intricately connected. We have a lot of callers lined up. I want to get to some of them now. First up is in Burlington, Vermont. Excuse me. Ted is on the line. Welcome to On Point, Ted.
Oh, thanks a lot. I just had a question for everyone there. One question and then a quick comment is, I understand that the climate and science has gone down in the opinion of people because of the economy, but what do they think about expressing to the people of the United States the idea of carrying capacity, the planet's carrying capacity, versus exponential population growth? Those are two things that when they clash, you know, something really bad is going to happen. And, you know, I think that that's something that needs to be expressed to the American public. You don't just, you know, they need to start looking at, like, future generations. And Obama's going to need to say some hard thing or some, you know, teach some tough lessons to people. And I think that's one of them. So that those two things, exponential growth and
population growth and how it might affect the economy.
Yeah, quick thing. The clean coal, I think, is anathema to most people. I mean, if you ask anyone in the Appalachian coal region, there's no such thing. So I think we need to think about things like wind power off the Atlantic and stuff like that.
Good point, Ted. Thanks. Let's go to your first question, Ted. Francesca Griffo, will you speak to that, the population growth straining the planet and those pressing questions that really affect the economy?
Well, I think, you know, what Ted's really getting at is resource consumption. And I think a lot of the things that John was just describing in the stimulus package and in our concern about clean energy and climate and all these other things are really addressing that. They're addressing, you know, the way we consume these various resources. And that's what's critical because obviously, you know, we in the United States have very high consumption levels and it really does behoove us to think very hard about how we can better design those systems so that we get more for less, essentially. And that really depends on, you know, on the research and on having you know, good science flow into the system and good science flow into the policy making.
And John Rennie, the caller says, Ted says, no such thing as clean coal. We got to look more at wind and power and these other resources.
Yeah, that's a pretty widespread sentiment in some areas. And I have to say, I think there's a lot to that. The fact is that even if you had a perfect state of carbon sequestration technology, the fact is that coal mining is itself very destructive to the environment in all kinds of ways. And we at this point, carbon sequestration is still, you know, it's still on the drawing board. We still don't really have any very well developed technology at all of that. So some people think that could be kind of a dodge, and that it's a mistake to pin too many hopes to what we're ever going to get out of carbon capture and sequestration.
Here's another.
And I think if I can just hop in there.
Sure,
I mean,
go ahead, Francesca.
One of these things that people are talking about, these midnight regulations, these very last minute things that the previous administration did. One of them, of course, is about mountaintop removal mining, which is just, you know, a dreadful practice that not only destroys, you know, the valley surrounding where they're removing the mountaintops, but is a huge issue for water quality.
What about, go back to this point that you talked about earlier, about President Obama talking about restoring science to its rightful place. You talked about transparency and a couple of these other issues, but speak more specifically to that, Francesca. Building, you know, federal scientific workforces, the independence of mind and a voice of these scientists. What exactly are we talking about?
Well, I think, you know, we're talking about transparency, and let me take a minute and go into that in a little more detail, because I think we've seen a wonderful first step. You know, the executive order on FOIA, which is the Freedom of Information Act, and on transparency that came out the day after the inauguration are critical, critical first steps. But what we need is actually the specificity that's going to be attached to those. We need to know that federal scientists have media policies that allow them to speak out. And we know from our research that right now many agencies don't have media policies that allow that. We need publication policies. You know, part of the scientific process is this, you know, huge amounts of communication amongst and between scientists. And we need a federal system that really encourages that for our federal scientists. And we need a transparency policy for meetings. I mean, the American public need to know who are their decision makers seeing on a day-to-day basis, what's going on in those meetings. So we need to figure out ways to open that process up. I think the transparency piece is so important because obviously we can't, you know, have our eyes and ears everywhere, so we need to open this system. And as I said, I think, you know, President Obama has taken that valuable first step of stating that we are going to reverse what has been the case, which is we are now going to have releasing of information be what is done, and only when we have to do we keep information back. And I think that's going to be very, very important.
Let's go to another call now from Shelburne, Vermont. Rita is on the line. Rita, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. Hi, sure. Jane, and
hi.
Hello to your guests. My question is, I think it's great that science, it looks like the Obama administration wants to make science and its contributions more transparent to the American people. One of my biggest concerns is health, you know, obviously health care, and really what that means in terms of a paradigm. We hear so much about the healthcare costs and, you know, we need more healthcare delivery to the people of the United States so that it's more equitable, et cetera. My big concern is what is the science of healthcare? It scares me a little bit because science, when I think of the term science, I think so much of the old standard science. And I would like to see more ethics and common sense in both science, healthcare in terms of pharmaceuticals, the FDA in terms of what is food, you know, and getting additives and stuff out of food, but also mostly the pharmaceuticals as healthcare. I think that's a misnomer, and I think it's a cultural, it's a sort of a sign of cultural lag and maybe cultural demise almost. I think we need a huge paradigm shift in there, and I'm wondering what the scientists plan to do to really bring back some of the old
ethics and common sense. You said it earlier, Rita. Thanks so much. It's a good question. John Rennie, what do you think?
Yeah, it's obviously it's a very big question, and I think what Rita has asked is a question. In a lot of ways, it does go well outside just purely scientific issues. It really goes to the question of what we as a society want our healthcare system to be, and how we want it to be socially responsible. Scientists have lots of views about that. If I'm taking part of Rita's question the right way, the question of how are scientists investigating some kinds of technologies are being applied and whether they're appropriately open-minded enough about some kinds of alternative medicine, for example. Those things are all that are being explored. I think that there are generally some fairly responsible programs in place for trying to make sure that people are checking out what is might actually have some sort of benefit, but they also it's their job to try to point to things that don't seem as though that they are working the way that they are supposed to as well.
Francesca,
actually, if I can jump in there on the Food and Drug Administration, because I think this is an agency where the top FDA officials, you know, have put politics and the priorities of commercial interests above public health and safety.
In what way? Can you give an example?
Well, yeah, Vioxx, for example, you know, a drug that had problems, a drug that one of the reviewers within the FDA, John Graham, was, you know, trying to bring the attention to, but there were no whistleblower protections for him. He was not in a position to be able to speak out public. Ultimately, he did with the protection of Congress, but it was not out there at the time that we needed it. We've seen this over and over with Avandia and Keytec and, you know, a very long list of these drugs. But I think the primary problem at FDA is industry became their client. Because of the way that FDA was being funded, money was coming from industry to support the review of drugs, And in doing it that way, you know, people were being promoted not on how safe and effective the drugs that they approved were, but rather how many of those drugs they could move through the pipeline, because that meant more resources. So one of the things that we did see over the last 8 years are these fundamental shifts, these systemic changes in the way agencies operate. And that's going to take a lot of work to not only identify and find those systemic changes, but to turn them around. And FDA is going to be an important place to start that process.
That's an excellent point.
Back to the phones now. John is in Franconia, New Hampshire. Hi, John. Welcome to our discussion on Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
It's a statement I'd like to make in terms of the environment and our energy issues, and in terms of funding the stimulus package that the president is talking about. And the one thing we can do as a nation in terms of the American people contributing and also keeping pressure on and awareness on the efficiency of vehicles and pressure on the car manufacturers to continue to put their emphasis on efficiency is if we had a national gas tax. While the price of gas is low right now, we could help fund the stimulus package. It would be a way that all the Americans can contribute. We'd still be more aware of the discretionary use of fuel and the understanding that every day 17% of the fuel we use is because of SUVs and on top of the fuel we would otherwise be using. Mm. What the president could do with a national gas tax is to rebate to people that make, say, less than $40,000 or $50,000 a year that don't have the ability to buy more efficient cars because of their budget. Mm. And it could also rebate to small businesses that use vehicles and help stimulate them. But in the meantime, it's something we could do right away for the environment, for the efficiency of vehicles, and for the American people to contribute.
It's a huge debate, John. Thanks for bringing it up. John Rennie, what do you think about that gas tax, national gas tax, to make improvements to infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is definitely an idea that has been proposed before, and I think it has all the points going for it that John was just mentioning it. I think people are very interested in seeing a number of different things about the ways in which taxes as instruments or other kinds of things can be used to try to encourage society to move in the right sort of directions. That's certainly one. A lot of whether or not that's ever enacted is going to depend a lot, obviously, on the views of well, the public at large, but also the people inside the Beltway and whether or not they want to try to put such a tax in place.
Francesca Griffo, before we go to a break here, I've got about a minute. I want to ask you about space policy moving forward. President Obama has been ambiguous about space policy. Scientists aren't so sure if he's going to go for some of the grand projects that former President Bush did or scale back. What's your take?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen over the last several years is that, you know, NASA research fell even within, a stable R&D budget, you know, because we did see resources being shifted from research to development. I mean, one of the things that our program has observed was, you know, that NASA even changed its mission statement to take the planet Earth out of it. So I think we've lost a lot of NASA's capacity to really help us understand climate change, to help us understand our own planet, you know, the elimination of some satellite programs or their delay. And I think as we look at climate change and look at these, you know, big environmental issues that we have to solve, that monitoring information is going to be critical so that we can do adaptive management, which just means that we learn as we go. We continue to gather more information so that we can make better decisions.
John Renmy?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think there's a lot of people are going to be very interested to see what kind of clarifications Obama brings to his positions on this very soon. Certainly a couple of the very pressing decisions are going to be about what we're going to do about the shuttle program and what, therefore, is going to happen to a lot of jobs in Central Florida.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of science and the new Obama administration. John Rennie is with us. He's editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Also with us is Francesca Griffo. She's director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation now. Robert Lanza joins us from Worcester, Massachusetts. He's chief scientific officer at Advanced Cell Technology, a biotech firm that conducts stem cell research. His company plans to seek FDA approval to run a study using embryonic stem cells to treat blindness. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yes. Hi, Jane.
So tell me, what's new at your lab these days with a new administration? How are you looking at things differently?
Well, of course, we're all very excited about a President Obama. This really marks a sad chapter in American scientific history where laws were actually passed to criminalize scientific research. So, of course, we're all now very optimistic that the restrictions on stem cell research will be lifted. And we're also pretty optimistic that he will now be listening to advice from the medical and scientific community rather than taking sides in religious debates. And of course, with the recent approval by the FDA, we now have the green light that we've been waiting for. The FDA now appears comfortable enough to begin clinical trials using embryonic stem cells.
And what is the potential for this kind of research as you see it?
Well, I think it's really enormous. We plan to file an IND with the FDA this summer to try to prevent blindness. There are also, of course, many other very important applications. We're hoping to also create blood for emergency situations, including military needs. You may remember a paper we recently published showing that it was possible to make whole tubes of blood in the laboratory. These blood cells were comparable to normal transfusible blood. We also have many other exciting applications. For instance, we recently created a population of cells known as hemangioblasts, and we found that these cells quickly repaired vascular damage. They actually, in animals, cut the death rate after a heart attack in half, and we actually completely restored the blood flow to ischemic limbs that would otherwise have to be amputated. Mm.
When you know that all this potential is possible, I mean, what have you been doing with your time and your resources and your research applications during this period of relative quiet?
Well, of course, during the Bush administration, it was almost impossible to raise money. We were, in fact, on the border of going bankrupt until, actually, President Obama was elected, and investors started to come out of the woodwork, and we did an about-face as soon as he came on board, and we're now thriving and, indeed, getting ready to begin human clinical trials.
Can you describe the feeling in your lab? Can you describe the attitude?
Oh, yeah, we're all, of course, very ecstatic. We're very excited, you know, and after almost a decade to finally see this field gaining some momentum, and this is a real jump start for the field.
Robert Lanza joining us from Worcester, Massachusetts, biologist, chief scientific officer at the Advanced Cell Technology, a biotech company, looking at embryonic stem cell research to treat blindness, among other things. Robert, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
John Rennie, your response to what you just heard from the good scientist.
Oh, as Bob Lanza said, I mean, it's a very exciting time. I think for the last 8 years, embryonic stem cell research has kind of been the poster child for thwarted science in a lot of people's minds. You know, the good news is that work on embryonic stem cells and stem cell research even more broadly has indeed moved forward over these past years, even in federal laboratories, notwithstanding the kinds of restrictions that were placed on them. That was the good part. But the fact is everybody in the field would agree that because they really were operating with both hands tied behind their back and having to hop on one leg the whole time, the whole rate of progress was greatly, greatly slowed. So I think everybody is very hopeful that that Obama is soon going to be officially revoking the kinds of restrictions that were in place, and that will bring about a kind of renaissance of embryonic stem cell research in federal laboratories or even in private laboratories that are ultimately dependent on the kind of federal attitude toward this area of work.
Francesca Griffo, this is probably the most controversial of the initiatives on the table. I mean, what do you see with the revocation of these restrictions?
Well, I mean, you know, it hasn't really been a political interference issue. It's really been more of an ethical and moral dilemma, I think, and those decisions have been based on that. But I think what's interesting is, you know, Dr. Lanza's enthusiasm is, you know, just wonderful to hear, but I think we really have to make sure that the scientific community continues to, you know, put pressure on the president, put pressure on the Office of Management and Budget, the Office of Technology Policy, to really sustain his support for science, because, you know, we have much to clean up. We've got lots of past issues to investigate, but I think what's really important is we have to look to how are we going to prevent these kinds of things from happening again in the future.
Let's go back to the phones now to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gwen is on the line now. Gwen, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, panelists. I understand that Al Gore is on the Hill speaking to a committee chaired by John Kerry, and I'm wondering what we concerned citizens, I'm not a scientist, can do to ensure, other than calling our Senator Kerry, Kerry's office and exhorting him to, you know, to insist on the standard of 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide as the maximum in the atmosphere, as our goal. How do we, what should we do to pressure the Obama administration into insisting on this goal as we go forward? And perhaps you could explain what I'm talking about.
We get the message, Gwen. Thank you. Francesca Griffo, what do you say to the caller?
Well, not to be too self-serving, but, you know, one of the ways that you can get some help in understanding what to do and having the right timing on how to do it is to sign up for the Union of Concerned Scientists action alerts. I mean, we have a climate change program that is very good at helping citizens and scientists alike to really engage in these policy issues and giving you the background information to help you make these decisions. So I would say come check out our website and you know, our climate program and our other programs, because we all work very hard to help citizens to be very involved in these issues.
We've actually dipped into the vice president, former vice president, speaking, testifying before Congress today. Here's a clip of that. He says that the U.S. can reinstate itself as a leader in climate change.
If Congress acts right away to pass President Obama's recovery package and then takes decisive action this year to institute a cap and trade system for CO2 emissions, as many of our states and many other countries have already done, and as many of the leading Fortune 500 corporations in America are pleading with the Congress to do, so they'll have predictability and the basis to become more competitive in world commerce, then the United States will regain its credibility and enter the Copenhagen Treaty talks with a renewed authority to lead the world in shaping a fair and effective treaty.
John Rennie, former vice president, makes reference to that big meeting in Copenhagen at the end of the year, which will really determine whether the U.S. does lead on this issue, no?
Right. That's really the sort of the follow-up to the big Kyoto treaty meetings back in the 90s, and it is the meeting that's really going to be determining the agenda for nations all over the world about how they're going to be addressing these climate issues. And, I mean, I think in a way the vice president is right, of course, in talking about the importance of the United States leading in a lot of that. But in a sense, that almost misrepresents it, because in a way, if the United States is not clearly, firmly committed to trying to reform its own policies with respect to energy and climate change, if it's not sending that as a clear signal to the rest of the world by the end of this year at those meetings, then it's pretty clear that the rest of the world will never be in a position to be able to move this very far. Hmm. Without the United States having this kind of buy-in, you're never going to get big concessions from China or India or any of the other rising powers that are going to be increasingly responsible for a larger and larger share of those kind of climate-changing factors in the atmosphere.
Francesca, you agree?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we have to pay attention to, you know, at home here, creating a well-designed cap-and-trade program, to establishing, you know, these strong emissions reduction targets, to really, you know, ensuring that climate legislation responds to emerging science, because, as I said, this is going to be a field that is rapidly changing. These clean technology solutions, you know, these national assessments of global change impacts, I mean, all of these are issues that we need to pay attention to at home in order to really be effective at these very, very important meetings.
More calls now. Frank is in Epping, New Hampshire. Frank, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks, Jane.
Yes.
I'd like to make a comment from a perspective of a former academic scientist, industrial scientist, entrepreneur, and CEO of an entrepreneurial business.
Okay, great.
And that is, what I would like to suggest to you is a very specific way in which an investment that the administration can make immediately that will enhance both employment in the scientific and engineering fields and will have long-term benefits. And that would be an increase in the number of grants that are given under the SBIR, or Small Business Innovation Research Program, and the analogous STTR program, in which technology is transferred from universities to small businesses.
Hmm. All right, Frank, thanks. Let's turn that to Francesca. John, who wants to tackle that? SBIR programs, an increase in funding for that?
I mean, John? I think that you're sure. I mean, I think that's sounds like it could very well be a good idea. I'm not familiar enough with the whole set of what would be the pros and cons of all of that. But on the face of it, almost anything that is increasing the rate at which you are trying to move a kind of research discovery over into the area of more industrial commercial development would obviously have real economic value. So on the face of it, that sounds like a good idea. I would love to know more of what the counter argument to that might actually be.
And I think, you know, the stimulus package that is being considered today really does want to, or is attempting to, jumpstart the economy by investing in environmentally responsible policies and projects that, you know, really would work in cooperation with natural systems. I mean, I think some of the things that will be investing in will achieve some of the same ends that our caller was after.
Mm-hmm. Here's Eric now, another caller, this time from Southbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Jane. The other callers and your guests have been so absolutely positive and optimistic about this that I thought I'd put in a note of negativism.
Okay, let's hear it.
Every time the U.S. gets into a real bind, they start talking about how wonderful science is and that we ought to support it and encourage people to go into science and so forth. I saw this when I was in the eighth grade, and people started talking about the space race. And suddenly there was a big push for, you know, to get to elevate science to a position of importance in the United States. And I didn't buy it then, and I don't buy it now. China has 100 times as many good scientists as the United States does. And for a long time, H-1Bs have been a big issue where foreign scientists are brought in, and American technical help is looking for some kind of work, and they can't find it. I worked for a company where they wanted to hire some foreign help, so they interviewed 20 United States engineers and pretended, these were sham interviews, they pretended that they didn't meet the qualifications. Then they screwed up something in the paperwork and they had to do it again and interview another 20 engineers. And then they went and hired foreign labor.
So I hear your point, Eric. Let me turn it, sorry to interrupt, but time's against us here. Francesca, this caller's not so sure about all these scientific plans and all this money going toward these projects. Not so sure it's such a good thing. Can you see his point?
You know, I think when science can add to the dialogue, when it can help inform a decision, then we need to make sure that science is there. Part of that is obviously having, you know, a very educated scientific workforce that can get in there. Are there bumps along that road? Absolutely. You know, is this a challenge that needs ongoing attention? Absolutely. But I don't think we want to throw away, you know, the baby with the bathwater here. I think just because sometimes making this work is difficult, I think the bottom line is that, you know, information leads to better decisions.
Let's squeeze in one more call before our time is up here. Caroline is in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm interested in education.
Okay.
I first learned about global warming by listening to public radio. Then I went to the Harvard Museum of Natural History and got some more information when they had a guy talk about the ice core samples that were taken. I bought Al Gore's book. Time magazine story freaked me out a little bit. So I'm really interested in helping to combat global warming. And that's the one thing that keeps me up at night. And, you know, I've been saving for college education, and now we saw our portfolio depleted by about 40%. My kids are in middle school. So one thing that I can control is, you know, voting for educational funding in my local town, but it would be great if we could get more funding for science education for our kids to encourage them to go into science. And one of the things that I have been doing on a personal level is I've been organizing field trips to MIT. They have an Edgerton Outreach Center. It's free. I can bring 25 kids to MIT, and they get all excited about different labs, and it's a wonderful thing. And if more colleges and universities did that, and reached out to middle school students to get them excited about college and science, it would be wonderful.
Caroline, thank you. Caroline talks about scholarships for science education. Francesca, do you see money in that, especially in the stimulus package?
Well, you know, I hear your pain. I have two boys in middle school, and, you know, the amount of science they get is very frustrating. I think one of the things that you can involve yourself in as we go forward is, you know, when we take a second look, when the feds take a second look at the No Child Left Behind, because I think in our rush to do math and reading, we have sometimes overlooked science and science education. I would also say on just a practical level, science fairs are an awesome way to get kids going and excited, and I'm sure you can look on your, you know, just Google Massachusetts and science fairs, and you'll find out what's out there for you on that.
John Rennie, I'm going to give you the last word as we wrap up our hour here. Your thoughts as you've heard everything that we've discussed today.
I mean, I think that if just in broad summary, I think, yes, this is very, certainly a very hopeful time. I think that a lot of us are, in a sense, waiting for the other shoe to drop about seeing how a lot of the very favorable rhetoric with respect to science used by Obama so far, how that does materialize into actual policies. But I think so far everybody is very encouraged. I think there a lot will depend on the final details of all of this. But I think it is still wonderful to see that we do indeed seem to have a fact-based, science-reliant administration again.
Really
interesting conversation, and I appreciate your perspectives. John Rennie, Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American, thanks so much for joining us, John.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Francesca Griffo, Director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Francesca, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.